Chapter 5. London, July 1986. I was wondering whether you could take a look at it.
Well, of course, sweetheart, but I can't promise anything.
Charlie, if anyone can find something out about this drawing, it's you. Charlie was a friend of mine from the Slade. He'd also been my boyfriend, briefly, though I generally chose to forget that part. I had at one time thought myself in love with him, hardly able to believe that someone like him, so confident and so talented, would be interested in me. Yet it transpired that he wasn't well suited to monogamy. When it ended, I had thought that what I felt was heartbreak. It was only after Mum's death, when I knew the true meaning of that word, that I understood it had not been so. It had been an infatuation, and my hurt and embarrassment, while terrible, had not been the true symptoms of a broken heart. Perhaps further proof of this was the fact that our friendship had survived the breakup. The only thing it hadn't survived, ultimately, was Mum's death, and this was entirely my own fault, or at least I thought it had not survived. Now I was surprised at how ordinary it felt to chat to him, almost as though only a few days had passed without our talking, rather than a good 6 months or so. I had expected formality or even coldness, but he sounded, if anything, pleased to hear from me. Charlie had been one of the few of us who had been able to make a career from his work, which was well deserved, as he was phenomenally talented. He also boasted an almost encyclopedic knowledge of the art world. It's my experience that most artists tend to go either way in their attitude to the artistic canon. Either they decide to reject knowledge of everything that has gone before, wanting to create freely, without the weight this awareness would bring, or they know the art world and its history inside out. Charlie was of the latter school. He told me once that he couldn't engage with subjects that didn't interest him, hence his limping away from his school years with a bare handful of O-levels. But when it came to things that did, such as his chosen field, he was astonishingly knowledgeable. He seemed pleased by my flattery, as I had guessed he would be.
All right, I'll give it a glance. Over dinner? I could cook for you.
This was dangerous. I wasn't flattering myself. Given an opportunity to seduce anyone, anything, Charlie would probably take it. I don't want to put you to any trouble over it. Why don't we meet somewhere in your neighbourhood? My treat. We ate at a cheap workaday Italian where Charlie seemed known to the staff, though it was unclear whether they treated every customer, regular or otherwise, with the same ersatz bonhomie. When I got up to use the ladies, I saw one of the waiters lurking outside the back door, cigarette in hand, scowling at the pavement, and I felt myself blush, as though I'd witnessed him in a state of undress. We ordered two vast buttery plates of linguine vongole and some cheap red wine. It was Charlie who brought up the subject of the drawing.
Well, let's see it then.
He wiped his mouth with his napkin and sat back in his chair, prepared, I thought, to be unimpressed. I drew the envelope out of my bag, suddenly nervous, my fingers clumsy and my heart thudding. Though it was the purpose of our meeting, I think I had been subconsciously putting off this part. I had a moment of hesitation. Did I definitely want to show him? I had convinced myself that it was in some way exceptional. If it was, to do so could be to set something in motion, something over which I might have no control. Though perhaps even worse than that would be to hear that it was nothing special after all, that I had been mistaken. I slid the drawing out and saw her face again, that geometric hair, those arching eyebrows like two elegant parentheses, and the softness of the other features that contrasted with them, the full lips, the quizzical, intelligent gaze. It was a simple sketch, as I have said, perhaps a study for a more permanent work. Yet each time I looked, I saw something in it that I had not noticed before. This time it was the fingernails on the elegant hand, the one held to her neck. They were bitten down, like a child's. The detail convinced me that the artist knew the subject well. In a more considered study, there would have been time to notice and incorporate such a feature. In a quick sketch, the work of a moment such as this, the artist would have to have known of it already. Charlie was silent for a long time as he studied it. His face, usually so mobile, was rigid with concentration. his eyebrows drawn together. He moved the paper closer and closer to his face until his nose almost touched its surface, and it would have made me laugh had I not felt so anxious. I sat there for several excruciating minutes as the chatter of the room washed over me and a siren blared past along the road outside. Finally, he looked up. His expression was impossible to read. "Kate!" It was only then I became aware of his excitement, heard the tremor of it in his voice. "Yes?" I'm almost certain that you might have something rather interesting here." I leaned forward, ready with my questions. He put out a hand and shook his head.
"I don't want to get your hopes up before I've checked it out."
"But you recognize the signature. You know who it's by."
"Well, that's a thing. I might do, but I need to make sure. I'll need to borrow it for a couple of days."
"No, you can't, I'm sorry." I reached to take it from him.
"Look, trust me, please. I'll treat it as carefully as gold dust, I promise. If I'm right, it practically is gold dust. Better, in fact."
"That's not why I..." He put up his palms.
I know, but as I say, I have to check. I have someone who will be able to tell me unequivocally either way."
He looked at me beseechingly. "Fine." I couldn't quite believe I'd said it. "But you must promise."
"I promise."
He covered my hand with his.
"I'll guard it with my life."
I returned home, excited and anxious, trying not to remember that time Charlie had lost the portfolio for his final degree piece in Waterloo Station, and I didn't sleep well the next couple of nights, envisaging terrifying scenarios in which he'd left the drawing on the tube or set fire to it accidentally. It came as a huge relief when, 3 days later, he finally called with directions to a private gallery in Islington. I was to meet him there at 7, after they'd closed to visitors for the day. When I got there, 5 minutes early, Charlie was already sitting on the step outside, drawing hungrily on the remains of a cigarette, his foot tapping. When he saw me, he dropped the butt and jumped up, launching himself towards me. He was vibrating with excitement, I could tell, though I tried not to infer too much from the sight of it. He took my arm.
"Come and meet Agnes."
Agnes was Swiss-German, in her 50s, with a handsome face framed by large round spectacles, grey hair drawn into a utilitarian topknot. I suppressed a smile. I'd assumed, knowing Charlie, that she would be some ravishing young ingenue with hair to her waist. She treated me to a firm handshake and ushered us into an immaculate office behind the exhibition space. The only colour came from the jewel-coloured spines of books on a shelf behind the desk, and a vast canvas of riotous, tessellated watercolour squares on the opposite wall that I recognised as a Paul Klee. Agnes was eager to get straight to business. She reached into the drawer of her desk and removed the drawing carefully, placing it between us with, it seemed, a certain reverence. Against the lacquered black wood of the desk, in a pristine new dust sheet, it looked decidedly small, old and grubby. "So," Agnes leaned forward and fixed me with pale blue eyes, surreally magnified by her lenses.
"Kate, remind me where you came across this work, please."
"Well, it's difficult to explain." I searched for the best way of putting it. "It's been in the family for a while, and it's recently come into my possession." Agnes nodded.
"The reason I ask is that I believe you have something extremely precious here. You had a suspicion of this before?"
I didn't know, to be honest. I've no eye for these things, not like Charlie, say, but it did seem good to me. I suppose I hoped it might be special."
"Indeed. Tell me," she peered at me, "are you aware of an artist named Thomas Stafford?"
I laughed. "Well, yes, of course I am." You didn't have to be an art historian to have heard of the man. He had achieved the distinction of becoming a national treasure. There had been a big retrospective of his work only a few months previously at the Tate, and I'd seen the poster for it on tube platforms. It had stayed with me particularly, that image, because it had been in such contrast to the rain-sodden April weather we had had at the time. It showed a view out across a sun-bleached window shelf, a blue wedge of sea, the white triangles of sails stark against it. But the drawing doesn't look like anything I've seen of his. Yet, even as I said it, I was thinking of those initials, S and T, T and S. Could it be?
No, said Agnes, patiently. It certainly doesn't look like his recent work, or indeed most of the work for which he is known.
Charlie cut in.
But you're something of an expert on his work, aren't you, Agnes?
Agnes gave a modest nod.
I'd have to be. I wrote my thesis on him.
She looked fondly down at the drawing.
This is, in fact, similar to other early works I've seen in style execution, even the materials used. He favoured pen and ink or charcoal in the early years, you see, perhaps before he'd got fully confident with using some of the more complex mediums. And I think because they were quick. He could get the effect of spontaneity that you see here. It was his later works, after the war, that got him noticed in a big way. She smiled. Several of his biggest fans, myself included, think that the earlier works have their own quiet brilliance. But this, her voice trembled with excitement, is the earliest piece I have ever seen. By a few years. The other earliest known works are from the 30s. She stroked the dust jacket. This is perhaps the best I've seen. The most fluent, the most true. I leaned forward.
So you're sure that it's by him?
She nodded her head, adamant. I'd bet quite a sum on it being his.
I watched as her finger traced the lines of the subject's face. Do you know who this woman is, though?
I'm curious about her.
A thrill went through me. I think she might be my relative.
Agnes raised her eyebrows.
Well, it seems a very... She searched for the right word. Familiar. Almost intimate piece.
I nodded.
I thought so too. But she doesn't appear later on, as far as I can recall. So perhaps not. That's why I'm interested in the picture, I said. Because of her. Oh, it's a long story, but I didn't know until recently that she existed.
The best person to ask, Agnes said ruminatively, would be the artist himself. But he's a recluse, Charlie said unhelpfully. He doesn't even live in the country.
Agnes nodded.
It's true. No one's seen much of him since his wife died. It's driven some of the collectors mad. He's always been prolific, and I think they imagine that he's sitting there producing pieces that no one can get their hands on. He's never seemed especially interested in money, you see, so I suppose he has no real reason to show them to anyone, if he doesn't want to.
How should I contact him? Agnes sighed.
That's the thing. It won't be easy.
Let me think on it. So I went home, trying to convince myself that this was progress. In truth, it was immensely disheartening to have this new lead, yet no apparent way of investigating it further. Agnes, too, had looked rather downcast when I left, though that might have been as much to do with the fact that I was taking the drawing with me. To make matters worse, the shop was even quieter than usual that week. The weather was terrible, despite it being early summer. The sky was an ominous, lowering, still grey, and the light had a greyish, dirty quality to it, too. It was hardly surprising that people did not feel compelled to think about their cameras. It also meant that my normal means of distraction, my own photography, was not an option. It was too wet most of the time for me to want to risk getting my camera out. It was old now, and prone to fail. I knew that rainwater could be just the thing to finish it off. I knew, too, that I could easily replace it. Nick would have given me a big discount on anything in the store. Yet I held on to it, stubbornly, for what I suppose were superstitious reasons. This was the camera with which I had taken picture after picture of Mum, and I had convinced myself that it held some final imprint of her inside its compact black body. Besides, it felt right in my hands, as though it had moulded itself to them, or I to it, a strange transmutation. I needed a new way to distract myself. One day, almost without realizing what I was doing, I took the tube to Green Park and walked into the Royal Academy. Only when I stood in the foyer, blinking in the bright light that was in such contrast to the mizzling day without, did I understand why I was there. I had come to look at the work of the artist who had suddenly become so uniquely important to me. I was impressed by what I found. I had peripherally been aware of Stafford's work, and I think I could, with confidence, had picked out one of his pieces in a room, one of the more recent ones at least. But here were older works, works that were far darker and more subversive than I would have imagined, as well as those of humour and great serenity. There was a vast range evident here. He favoured charcoal and ink for sketches, and oil for paint. But there were also pastels, watercolours, collages. Perhaps what linked them together was the confidence and fluidity of line and the emotional punch that almost every work delivered. I couldn't pinpoint what the New York street scene made me feel exactly, perhaps because it stirred a complicated mixture of emotions. Pity for the drunk or homeless men slumped along the sidewalk. A certain excitement, stimulated by the purplish suggestion of twilight, the cleverly rendered pinpoints of light that suggested a new night falling upon the city, charged with possibility for the men and women that strode in their finery past the sorry spectacle of the others. I could not decide if I liked it. It made one uncomfortable. No doubt that was the point. Another mark of the artist's skill. And the view out across a placid sea, the Mediterranean, I was certain. Viewed one way, it spoke of heavenly solitude. Viewed another, that solitude transformed, became melancholic. Perhaps, after all, it depended on what one made of it, what one brought of oneself to it. The next day I went to the library and got out a book about Thomas Stafford. It purported to be an illustrated biography, but the text was disappointingly meagre. The early years section was sketchy, and there was only a brief mention of the artist's time at Oxford University, where he had, apparently, joined a student art society. To my frustration, I could find nothing about a woman called Celia. Nothing about any other woman, in fact, until the section on his marriage to a Corsican woman named Elodia. The next book yielded little more. There was, however, one paragraph that gave me pause. There are thought to be a number of works unaccounted for from the early years when the artist was still a student at Oxford University. Rumour has it that these are the product of a particularly pivotal time emotionally and creatively in Stafford's life. But none of these works, if they exist, are in the public domain. The earliest works on record date from the mid-1930s, though it is likely that Stafford was already prolific before this period. At the time of publication, we can only hope that these suspected earliest works may one day surface and shed further light on the creative beginnings of this extraordinary artistic career. The earliest works on record date from the mid-1930s. Now I could understand why Agnes had been so excited. The drawing I had in my possession was dated 1929, half a decade before. Yet it wasn't so much excitement I felt at this realization as something more like dread. Could the absence of these pieces suggest that someone simply didn't want them to be found? The spell of bad weather broke, finally, on the Saturday of that week. It was my day off, so I took up my camera and cycled the Thames path as far as Richmond. But it was a limp, misty day, and I knew that the photographs I took would be second-rate at best. Frustrated, I made for home. There was a voicemail blinking on the machine when I got in. I listened, my heartbeat suddenly loud in my ears, almost deafening me. It was Agnes. "I may have found a way," she said cryptically. I called her back. "Oh, good," she said, as soon as she heard my voice. "I've been waiting by the phone all morning." She paused. "I shouldn't do this. It's completely unprofessional, you understand. But in the circumstances..." She dropped her voice, conspiratorially. "I can give you the address of his sister. She is the founder of a charity that awards art scholarships to offenders. A friend of mine exhibited some of the winners at his gallery and has given me the details." She gave a short, rather wild laugh. I let him believe that I needed to get in touch with her about a new project. No doubt he wouldn't have given it to me otherwise. So, you mustn't reveal how you came by it, if you can help it. She read out the address for me. No phone number, so you'll have to go to her and explain. Just turn up? Yes, I think so. She's your best hope if you want to get to him directly. If you go via the collector route, and in doing so alert someone else to the fact that you have this piece, you'll only get tied up in paperwork and financials. Here it was, I thought, as I hung up the phone. An end to my impotence, my opportunity to act. But with it, the doubt returned. It wasn't as though I would be helping Mum in any way by following this path. More to the point, would Mum have wanted me to follow it? That one time we had spoken on the subject, she had been adamant that she had no interest in her real parents. Yet the idea of giving up now was inconceivable. I think I was mostly driven by the hope of finding something that would make me feel less alone. For one with no family left to speak of, the prospect of discovering something about this woman and the shared history she had been a part of was irresistible. And so, I went to see Stafford's sister, Mrs. Delaney, where she lived in a Victorian building off Upper Street. Such a long wait followed my knock on the door that I began to wonder if no one was at home, but as I turned to go, it opened. "I'm sorry," she told me. "I've been watching a film with my grandchildren, and we had it up rather loud. It took me a while to realize that the sound hadn't come from the television." "My name's Kate Darling," I told her. "I'm here to ask for your help. It's about a picture." "All right," she said to my amazement, and just like that, beckoned me through. I was so surprised by this easy acceptance that I wavered on the doorstep for several seconds in confusion. I had spent the journey to Islington rehearsing exactly what I would say, thinking of ways to mask Agnes's part in the process, how precisely to lead up to the main crux of things, only to find it all superfluous. Mrs. Delaney led me straight through to the kitchen at the back of the house. The two grandchildren were apparently watching their film in the sitting room off the main corridor. Noise and teenage laughter surged over me in a great wave as I entered, and involuntarily I steeled myself against it. I had become so used to the silence of the house in Battersea, you see, that it felt almost like an assault. Mrs. Delaney was vital and upright despite her years, with a sort of handsome looks that are improved by age, undiminished, certainly, by the intricate atlas of lines that mapped her skin. The eyes were her most striking feature, blue as a wolf's, but with a softness to them that was unmistakably kind. Even so, I quailed slightly beneath her gaze. She saw too much, I felt. "So," she said, "how can I help you?" I had deliberated beforehand as to how much I should tell her, especially as I myself knew so little. "I need to get in touch with your brother," I started, and then stopped. No, that wasn't quite how I had planned it. I tried again. "I'm trying to find out about someone your brother once knew." Mrs. Delaney waited, patiently, as I searched for a way to continue. In the end, I simply removed the drawing from my bag. I showed it to her, and saw her give a start when she saw it properly, as she took in the initials in the lower corner. "How did you come by this?" she asked softly. "It's been in my family for a long time." I hoped that would be enough. To my relief, she seemed to accept it. She took it from me wordlessly, and the kitchen clock counted out a full 2 minutes as she studied it. Eventually, slightly unnerved, I spoke into the silence. "I'm trying to find out something about her. The woman it depicts?" "Well," she said, still studying the drawing, as though unable to tear her eyes from it. "This is rather surprising. I have to admit that I wasn't expecting it to be about my brother's work. Not many people connect us because we don't share the same surname. I had actually thought it would be something to do with Beyond the Canvas, the charity I work for." She looked at me then. "I imagine that's how you got my address, though." "Through someone there?" It wasn't spoken as an accusation, but I felt my cheeks grow hot with embarrassment all the same. I nodded. "Anyway," she said, waving a hand to show it didn't matter, However it came about, I do think I see how important this is to you, and my answer is yes. Excuse me? I asked, rather stupidly. I mean to say that yes, I will help you to contact him. That was what you asked, I think. Oh, well, thank you. You should write to him, she told me, and I think you must include this drawing. No, I can't. It came out more fiercely than I had expected, and it seemed impertinent. It was her brother's work, after all. I tried to explain. Sorry, I said, but I couldn't bear the thought of losing it. She nodded. All right, a photocopy then. I forget there are these modern alternatives. But if I know my brother, it is this drawing that'll make him take notice. She saw me out. Goodbye then, Kate darling. She gave me a quick smile. Good luck. Sitting on the tube on my way back, I thought of what it could mean, having Thomas Stafford's address. Did I want to follow this thread, not knowing where it might lead? Again, I had that feeling that had been with me since Evie had first unburdened herself, that she might almost unwittingly have been protecting Mum from her own history. I thought of the sight that the girls in the orphanage had described, the woman who had left the baby on the doorstep without a backward glance, without even stopping to ring the doorbell. What sort of person would do that to their child? What if the truth I uncovered was a terrible thing, something that once unleashed could not again be hidden or forgotten? But then a rebellious voice spoke to me from the edge of thought. It's up to you, it whispered. You're the only one left to decide. By the time I got home, I had made my decision. I would write my letter, and I would do the closest thing to sending the drawing, photograph it, and send that instead. I took several versions in the kitchen where the light was good, and developed them meticulously in the darkroom. They all came out rather well, but I chose the one in which the expression on her face had been best retained. That wry smile, the slight quirk of the eyebrow. I tried to keep the note that I would send with it short, to the point, resisting the temptation to steep it in my anxiety and hope. Dear Mr. Stafford, please accept my apologies for writing to you directly in this manner, but I obtained your address from your sister, Mrs. Delaney, and am hoping you may be able to help me with something very close to my heart. I enclose a photograph of a drawing that I believe may be your own work. It recently came into my possession, along with a letter, sent 30-odd years ago, by a woman claiming to have given birth to my mother. This was addressed to my adoptive grandmother, and signed simply, Celia. Celia asked to meet with my mother, a request that was never granted. My mother, the ballerina June Darling, died last year without knowing anything of this. If the drawing is indeed your own work, perhaps you know something of the woman it depicts. The resemblance to my mother is uncanny and, I have come to believe, speaks for the truth of the letter's claim. I am desperate to learn of all you might know or remember. I think you may be the only person who can help me, who may be able to tell me anything of who she was. Yours faithfully, Kate Darling. I gave the address of the house and the number. As I fed the envelope into the mouth of the postbox, my hands shook. For a couple of weeks there was nothing. I was extremely vigilant. My hope, a quiet, desperate hope, was strong within me. Every day, as soon as the post arrived, I would hurl myself down the stairs and watch as the letters spilled through the door, catching them sometimes before they touched the mat. Nick knew that something was up. I was listless and distracted at work. Even a trip to the nearby Cadogan Arms for a medicinal glass of wine didn't help. He asked me if there was anything I might want to chat about. He knew about Evie, and probably thought it related to that. I didn't want to talk. For one thing, I didn't want to explain that there was anything besides the loss of Evie occupying my thoughts. And I felt a superstition, however foolish, that to speak of it would be to jinx it. I think it often happens like this. You wait and hope until eventually the hoping seems in vain and the thing you wish for begins to seem impossible. You try to forget, to move on, and sometimes, once you have gone through this painful process, by some peculiar alchemy, it happens. The reply came just like that. For once, I hadn't even heard the soft drop of letters as they hit the floor. I wasn't even in the house, having gone out to buy milk and the papers. When I returned, there it sat, a small white envelope addressed in an unfamiliar hand, a foreign postage stamp. My fingers were clumsy as I opened it.
"Dear Kate, if I may, please forgive my delay in replying to you. The post takes an extraordinarily long while to arrive here. The house is rather remote, you see. It has also taken me some time to organize my thoughts sufficiently to sit down and write. I will be honest and tell you now that your letter and photograph have disturbed me somewhat. I never thought I would see that drawing again. I think you should come to Corsica. Can you spare the time? I feel we have much to discuss, of the sort that can't be addressed in a mere letter. Please know that if you decide to come out, you need not concern yourself about accommodation. You would be my guest here at the Maison de Vent. We aren't particularly smart, but I'd like to think you would be comfortable. I hope the enclosed will help. It will, I think, be sufficient to cover the price of a flight to the island. An odd conceit, perhaps, but we do not have a telephone here. So, if you are inclined to accept my offer, though I appreciate that it may be difficult to find enough time for a visit, please send word of when you expect to arrive, and we will make sure that someone is there to meet you at the airport. If you are not bound by a schedule, my advice would be to book a single flight and decide once you are here on when to book the return. I feel that what we have to discuss may take us some time. I await your reply, Kate, and I hope, more than hope, that you will choose to come and visit us as soon as you are able. Yours truly, Thomas Stafford.
When the check fell into my hand, I sat down hard on the sofa and stared at it in bewilderment. It was for £1,000.